Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
99 weeks worth of unemployment benefits is a long time. With the recession officially at 133 weeks, though, and counting, today the White House really started leaning on Congress to do something. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Good to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 19th of July today. And about the easiest way to describe the economic news from the White House today is like this. President Obama is sick and tired, and he is not going to take it anymore. Mr. Obama used the Rose Garden to full political advantage this morning, taking off after Republicans in the Senate who are against extending unemployment benefits.
After years of championing policies that turned a record surplus into a massive deficit, the same people who didn't have any problem spending hundreds of billions of dollars on tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans are now saying we shouldn't offer relief to middle-class Americans who really need help.
Republicans have their own take on that debate, of course, that it's not about extending those benefits, but rather just finding a way to pay for it. About the only thing the two parties agree on, publicly anyway, is that they would like the economy to get better. So we asked Marketplace's Jeff Tyler how effective unemployment benefits really are as a kind of mini stimulus.
In terms of stimulating the economy, unemployment benefits are about as good as it gets, so says Sylvia Allegretto, an economist with the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment at UC Berkeley.
As far as a bang for the buck measure, extending unemployment benefits is one of the most efficient spending increases that the government could pass.
Most economists agree, including Josh Bivens at the Economic Policy Institute.
It's money that gets spent right back in the economy right away. It is going, by definition, to very cash-strapped people, and that's what makes for effective fiscal stimulus, money that is put back in the economy right away.
Some states need the money more than others. In Nevada, for example, the unemployment rate is now above 14%. Sylvia Allegretto says states like California and Ohio would also benefit.
It's targeted to unemployed people. So in states and cities where you have higher rates of unemployment, more monies go to those areas.
Republicans argue against anything that will add to the federal deficit, but economist Bivens says extending unemployment benefits is a short-term liability.
It's temporary. These things go away when the economy improves.
He says tax cuts, and especially corporate tax breaks, have proven less useful in stimulating the economy. The Senate will vote on an extension for unemployment benefits tomorrow. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
It's been a little bit over a year now since General Motors and Chrysler made their way out from their speedy bankruptcy proceedings. In all the push to trim down and cut costs last year, the White House pushed both automakers to shut down dozens and dozens of dealerships. That decision is the subject of a new report from the TARP Inspector General this morning, the guy whose job it is to keep an eye on the troubled asset relief package, the bank and car company bailout deal. The report says that closing those dealerships may have been right, but the way it happened was all wrong, and it cost the economy both jobs and confidence. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
When GM and Chrysler decided which dealerships to shut down, they looked at factors like how many other dealerships there were in an area and how many cars they were selling. Kim Hill works at the Center for Automotive Research, where he looks at the relationship between communities and the auto industry. He says there should have been a lot more to the equation.
There's this whole issue of how these dealers more broadly impact the local region, and there's the public side to the role the dealership plays in a community.
Car dealers really are often big employers, especially in rural communities, and they're always big multiplier effects. They hire building contractors and cleaners. Their employees spend money in communities. Michael Smitka is an economics professor at Washington and Lee University. He says the car dealer business has been getting smaller for decades, and rather than forcing dealerships to close, they could have just let the attrition continue.
Letting nature take its course would have been a much better way of handling it.
The Borofsky Report says the government should have found a way to let more dealers survive or at least hang on for longer. Smitka says that misses the point.
From my perspective, the number of dealerships that can make money selling GM vehicles sounds like a pretty good number of dealerships to me.
The Treasury Department says it had to act, and quickly. If Chrysler and GM had gone under, the economy would have lost hundreds of thousands of jobs across multiple industries. And though there might be criticism of the technique, one thing is true. Both GM and Chrysler emerged from bankruptcy as stronger companies. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Last May, Marketplace's Amy Scott made her way up to Newtown, Connecticut to talk to Daniel Amaral, then the proud proprietor of Amaral Motors' five-star Chrysler dealership. The morning Amy talked to him, he had gotten one of those Dear John letters from Chrysler telling him he would be losing his franchise. So we called him back to get his take on the IG report that came out this morning. Mr. Amaral, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So when you read the news this morning about this Inspector General's report and the car dealerships and its criticisms of what the government did, were you a little bit, yeah, told you so?
See, that's what I thought. You know, you have customers that I would say depended on you, and you take care of them. And they bought one car after the other. And I know we're going to metro markets now where they want to sell volume. But see, your customer wants to bring it to the local dealer, have it serviced. I don't think they really thought about. So I'd say that's just one thing.
If Chrysler called you tomorrow and said, you know what, Dan, we made a horrible, horrible mistake, and we want you back in the Chrysler family, what are you going to say?
Well, see, I might consider it. Because in the meantime, I've looked for different franchises.
You have?
Yes.
How's it going?
Well, they all want a new building. So to me, I see nothing wrong with this building. Okay, if we renovated it, whatnot, okay, that could be fine. But to come up with a brand new building, it wouldn't be paid for in my lifetime.
So how's business been? How have you been staying afloat?
You know, we've kept going, and we're doing all kinds of repair work on all different makes and models. We're selling used cars. I went from a new car license to a used car license. See, the other thing, the other side besides the car, see, the banking industry isn't as cooperative as they could be.
Oh, so your customers can't get the loans to buy your cars, right?
If you've got expensive cars.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've tried to do is go $3,000 to $10,000. Good car, dependable, and it fits, because usually the people can afford that.
And you don't need a loan.
And you don't need a loan. Yeah. I'm getting by, but of course now I'm working harder and harder to keep these things going.
Daniel Amaral used to be a Chrysler dealer in Newtown, Connecticut. Now he sells used cars. Mr. Amaral, thanks so much for your time.
Okay. Yep. Bye.
On Wall Street today, not much real economic news, just the promise of positive corporate profits. Traders reacted positively. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For the past couple of seasons, advertising in glossy magazines like Glamour has been practically a fashion don't. Print ad revenues were down 18% last year. They're still lagging. The drought, though, may break this coming fall. A lot of fashion magazines are reporting that their upcoming September issues, traditionally the really big ones, are going to be stuffed with ad pages. But it's not the latest hemline trends or new over-the-knee boots that are driving sales. It's that darned iPad. Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
Glamour's iPad deal has online sales driving print ads, not the other way around. Advertisers that want a top spot on the iPad app also have to buy space in the magazine's print edition. The New York Times reports Glamour's ad pages are up 57% for September. Marissa Gluck with Radar Research says the print online union is long overdue.
Print has been struggling for over a decade now, trying to figure out how to compete with online. And I think that they finally figured out that they're not supposed to compete with online. They're supposed to work together.
Gluck says it took an innovation like the iPad for magazines to let go of their organizational denial. More than 3 million of the tablets sold in just over 3 months, and demand still growing. Noah Elkin is a senior analyst at eMarketer. He says no brand manager can ignore the iPad's touch web.
The ability for the consumer to interact with web content using a touchscreen is a very dramatic difference from the way that people interact with content on the desktop, the screen.
But the iPad's touch can't prop up print forever. Forecaster Faith Popcorn with the Brain Reserve says it's a support system for an eroded model.
As the applications get better, you're going to go, what do I need a magazine for? My goodness, it's heavy. When you see something in your mailbox, you go like, yeah, how fast can I get rid of this?
Glamour says the combination of both print and digital opportunities has been very attractive to the ad community. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
You know what else is attractive ad-wise? Young people. That 18 to 34-year-old demographic that every marketer in the country wants to sink its claws into. But here's a news flash. There is some data out from Nielsen Research that shows baby boomers, those late 40 to early 60-somethings, earn more than the younger folks, are likely to continue doing so, and are buying more consumer goods, wireless services, even Apple computers. So riddle me this. Why aren't we seeing more boomers in the ads for all those products? Here's Marketplace's Eve Troe.
There's a cherished idea in advertising that people develop brand loyalty by their 40s and stick to it. Jim Gilmartin of the marketing firm Coming of Age says that's out of date. Today's over 50 crowd is open to new products and ideas, but no one has invested in selling to them.
The companies that are selling products and services typically are not taking the time to really understand the rapidly changing and aging marketplace and what it means to their business and how you connect with these folks.
He says ad agencies also tend to fill their ranks with younger people. Boomers and older generations represent $2 trillion in spending power, but Gilmartin says the argument against going after them often comes down to this.
It's just not cool.
Well, probably isn't.
That's the baby boomer I know best, my mother, Joan Trow. She's in her 60s, and she says she's not so interested in being cool. That doesn't mean she isn't interested in new products, like her toothpaste.
If it is a new thing, which in fact the toothpaste I'm currently using is a new whitening, brightening, do-everything-all-in-one package, I can be swayed to buy it.
But that decision is likely to be based on price, not style.
Whatever is on sale, or whatever someone has been kind enough to send me a coupon for.
Because, like so many boomers, she's watching costs as she gets ready to retire. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
When you do it voluntarily, traveling can be great. When you do it because you have to, then it's work. People spending their days in generic corporate conference meetings and nights in impersonal hotel rooms. For our series Road Warriors, producer Michael Raphael is introducing us to some business travelers and the music they listen to when they're out on the road or waiting at the airport.
I'm Dave Kirby from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm one of the owners of a company that does business seminars and consulting for the hair salon and spa industry. One of the songs that I listen to very often when I'm on the road is a song by Garth McDermott called Some Other Year.
I got nothing on my sleeve that gets us out of here. Look at all these dreams and dumb for anything.
There's some lyrics from that song that pop into my head frequently when I'm traveling, and it's the opening lines of the song. I've got nothing up my sleeve that gets us out of here. Look at all these strings that don't pull anything. You know, being a frequent flyer, I get a lot of perks and privileges, but there are certain situations where none of that stuff helps you, and like when Mother Nature throws a hissy fit and there's a big snowstorm, everyone's kind of in the same boat, and in those instances, I use the music to kind of help me maintain equilibrium and equanimity while the rest of the flying universe is going insane.
Some other day, some other year. I got nothing on my sleeve that gets us out of here. Look at all these strings that don't hold anything. Oh, maybe we've been on the road to rest. Shadows of the ones who packed a punch.
My dad was a musician when I was growing up, and I've been playing in bands since I was in sixth grade, so music's always been a really deeply personal thing to me, and I'd say that I feel it more than hear it.
I'll start on my own. If
That's how I fell.
I became a hairdresser in 1983 after getting kicked out of cosmetology school twice. You know, I just managed to get around some good people that helped me turn my career around and taught me the business of making money in the salon business. And it's an industry that's largely been filled with artists. There's never been a resource for them to learn the business of the business. And so, you know, being one of the owners of a company that provides those tools to people is really an amazing thing. And, you know, it really, we're helping a lot of people. And to me, that's the most enjoyable part of it.
Also enjoyable is the new music section on our website. You can check out Dave's other favorites there or offer up your own playlist for us. It's all on our homepage, marketplace.org. Coming up, farming, not fighting in Afghanistan.
If we can grow a middle class in Afghanistan, if we can create wealth opportunities through agriculture and through their own exports, then eventually they will need more of our agricultural products.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, Wall Street caught a bit of a break today. The Dow Industrials tacked on 56 points, about 0.5%, closed at 10,154. The NASDAQ picked up 19 points, more than 0.75%, 2,198 at the bell. The S&P 500 edged up 6 points, a little more than 0.5%, ended things at 1,071. The markets recovered from an early sell-off that was triggered by some disappointing housing news. The National Association of Home Builders said its confidence index dropped to its lowest level since March of 2009. Shares of home builders crumbled. Lennar sought off 1.33%. Toll Brothers and D.R. Horton each slumped about 1.25%. Today, shares of energy services giant Halliburton hit pay dirt. The company reported nearly $500 million in quarterly profits. Today, shares gushed up 6%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. And by the Henry Luce Foundation, seeking to increase American understanding of East and Southeast Asia. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for June. The House Ways and Means Oversight Subcommittee examines the need for charitable assistance to help residents and wildlife in the Gulf Coast region. And the Senate Judiciary Committee is scheduled to vote on the nomination of Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You've probably stood in those security lines at the airport and wondered to yourself whether it all works, whether we're safer for the billions that we've spent on national security and intelligence gathering since September 11th. Truth is that we don't know. That's the gist of a new series in the Washington Post today, Top Secret America, it's called. The Post's investigative reporter, Dana Priest, helped write it. Dana, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get too far into this, give us the thumbnail sketch of how big the intelligence industrial complex in this country is.
We've counted about 1,900 corporations that work at the top secret level and about 1,300 separate government organizations that do work at the top secret level. We found that these operate in about 10,000 locations across the United States and that over 850,000 people, government and contractors, have top secret clearances to do this work.
And this has largely happened since September 11th. I mean, we've had intelligence in this country for a while, but September 11th is the real starting point.
Well, the growth of it is really started after 9/11 when Congress and the administration wanted perhaps understandably, to pour more money in this to increase the capability in response to the attacks. The problem was the money flow didn't stop and the coordination didn't get better, so that people inside of the system don't know how many people work in it, how many agencies are doing the same thing, and really they can't even tell whether it is keeping us safer because it's just become so complex.
Let's talk about the money for a second. You say in this first piece today that the intelligence budget in this country publicly announced is about $75 billion plus or minus, but we don't really know what's not in there.
Well, we know there are a lot of military programs that aren't in there, and so the budget is bigger than $75 billion. And the $75 billion is 2.5 times bigger than it was on 9/11. We know that some agencies, like the National Security Agency, which does all the eavesdropping and intercepting of communications, has grown twice as big. So we have indicators all over of how big it has grown. But the actual number is classified if they actually had the actual number.
Do we have any sense of how much this intelligence boon has meant to the companies who are contracting with the government, how much money they're making?
You can see in general that the contractor ranks has swelled and new companies are born every day. And those companies are gobbled up once they start making a lot of money, and the large companies are only getting bigger. It's almost a recession-proof industry. Actually, it is a recession-proof industry at the moment. It has a low unemployment rate. They are always seeking workers, and they aren't laying off at all in the way that other sectors are.
But you had a conversation with Leon Panetta, the director of Central Intelligence, in which he basically said, listen, I'm making plans on how to change the CIA because our current budgeting and spending on this kind of thing is not sustainable. Are you seeing that amongst other insiders inside the intelligence agencies?
Well, if you think the defense secretary, Robert Gates, is an insider, I'd say yes, because he said the same thing. He said, we have to be prepared to cut back. He says, the only way we can really do that reasonably is to have a intelligent conversation about risks and risk assessment. What do we really need to spend money on? And is it wise every time there is an incident or a mistake to pile on more money and have that be the main solution to things that don't go right? Because more is not always bigger, but more is always the answer right now.
Dana Priest, she's an investigative reporter with The Washington Post. Her series Top Secret America and a whiz bang accompanying Web Element as well launched today. Dana, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Kabul, Afghanistan today. She's there for a big international donor conference, how to spend the $13 billion in aid that's been promised. The secretary's trip is all about civilian assistance, using it with the military to help stop the Taliban. The strategy actually starts long before troops actually get into Afghanistan, in one case with farming lessons, as Sarah McCammon reports now from Iowa Public Radio.
It's a warm and windy afternoon at a research farm near Iowa State University in Ames. Iowa National Guard Captain Pat Berge and several other soldiers are learning to use narrow metal tools to drill into the ground and pull out soil samples. Berge is an accountant, but on the particular mission he is training for, there could be times he's called upon to get in the dirt alongside his colleagues.
So I need to learn this technique just as well as some of our soil guys that already know it on the team.
Many of his fellow trainees do have farming backgrounds, which is why they were chosen for this agribusiness development team of about 65 Air and Army National Guard members. Staff Sergeant Ben Groth grew up on a farm and has an agribusiness degree, but he says that doesn't mean everything will be familiar.
I was told it's going to be like back in the Bible ages. There's no technology over there, and it's going to be extremely primitive.
The mission's goal is to help Afghans establish the infrastructure to grow enough food to feed themselves and eventually export it. The National Guard has been sending similar teams to more than a dozen Afghan provinces since 2008. The Iowa team will replace a group from the California National Guard, which was the first in Kunar Province. Among them is First Lieutenant Robert Perry. Speaking by internet phone from Kunar, he says many Afghans live in such desperate circumstances that they're easy targets for recruitment by insurgents.
When you have no money and you have no job, and the best you can do to feed your family is
a few jarabs of wheat that aren't even going to come in for 4 months, going out and cranking a few shots at the Americans for $5, you don't have a lot of choices.
There's also hope that Afghanistan could one day become a market for American farm imports. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack says he has more than 60 staff members in Afghanistan working with the military and local citizens.
If we can grow a middle class in Afghanistan, if we can create wealth opportunities through agriculture and through their own exports, then eventually they will need more of our agricultural products. They may begin to consume more meat, for example. And so that might increase beef exports, for example. So building a middle class through a strong agriculture helps our producers eventually by creating additional markets that don't exist today.
But some observers say it may be difficult for outsiders to win the confidence of Afghans. Rory Anderson is with the Christian relief organization World Vision.
Groups that are coming for short term, they can provide specific technical expertise, but do they have the time to really spend the months to build the trust and to build the relationships? And then once you've built the relationships, it takes time to see the returns and the results.
Anderson says her group mostly hires Afghan nationals to work with their target communities. Guard officials say while individual units only stay about a year, they try to establish continuity between teams. Staff Sergeant Groth says he's a little nervous, but mostly excited about the chance to use his farming knowledge in Afghanistan.
I think it's really great that we're going over as like a humanitarian mission instead of going over to kick in doors and kick butt or whatnot, but it's exciting. We're going to go over to help the people over there.
The Iowa Guard's agribusiness development team deploys to Afghanistan early next month. In Ames, Iowa, I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, China's takeover of the global economy has advanced another notch. The International Energy Agency says that last year China was the world's biggest consumer of energy. Beat the U.S. by about 4%. Not that that's a category we should want to be winning, I guess. It's measured in tons of oil used, or the equivalent. China, as it happens, gets most of its energy from coal, which is why they became the world's biggest absolute producer of greenhouse gases just a couple of years ago. Per capita, of course, the U.S. still uses more energy than anybody else around does. And on that note, that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow up 56 points, about a half percent. The NASDAQ gained 19, more than 3/4%. The S&P 500 added 6 points. That's a little bit more than a half percent on that particular index. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, spending our last few dollars on the last few months of life.
At a certain point, layering on additional care, as many people have put it, extends dying but does not really extend life.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.